Hi, this is Allison. I'm a producer here at On My Mind. Diane's out this week recovering from a voice treatment. While she's away, we're bringing you a conversation she had back in February as part of the Diane Reem Book Club. It's a discussion of the 1619 Project, a new origin story, featuring three of the book's contributors. With a focus on the legacy of slavery in this country, it seemed appropriate to release this now, days before Juneteenth, a holiday that commemorates the emancipation of enslaved people in the U.S. Find out more about the Diane Reem Book Club at dianereem.org/bookclub.
Welcome, all of you, to the February meeting of the Diane Reem Book Club. Today, we discussed the 1619 Project, a new origin story, created by Nicola Hannah-Jones and the New York Times Magazine, an expansion of the award-winning magazine issue. The book attempts to reframe our understanding of history, placing slavery and its legacy at the center of the American story. It's an approach that has inspired praise and backlash from classrooms to the presidential campaign trail to state houses throughout the country. Joining me to discuss the 1619 Project, a new origin story, are three contributors to the book, Martha S. Jones, history professor at Johns Hopkins University, Jamel Bowie, columnist for the New York Times, and Jake Silverstein, editor-in-chief of the New York Times Magazine, who also edited the book. Welcome to all of you. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Diane.
And Jake Silverstein, I'm going to start with you because you helped steer this idea right from the beginning. Tell me where the idea for the 1619 Project came from and how it evolved.
Sure. This is a project that has been evolving over the last 3-4 years in some pretty dramatic ways, but it began very simply. It began with Nicole Hannah-Jones, the creator of the project and lead author of the project, who is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and has been since 2015. Nicole had actually been on a book leave for the year of 2018, and she came back from that book leave at the beginning of 2019 in January. She came to one of the weekly ideas meetings that we have at the New York Times Magazine, where, you know, we kick around different ideas about what we might do. And Nicole said, well, it's 2019. It's this August is going to be the 400th anniversary of 1619. And I'm betting, she said, that this is a momentous anniversary that's not going to be memorialized to the extent that it should based on what she saw as its importance in American history. And we should do something to rectify that. We should do a special issue of the magazine, she said, that would in various ways commemorate the arrival of the first enslaved Africans in the British North American colonies in August of 1619 and explore the many ways in which the legacy of slavery still affects and distorts American society today. That was where it began. And of course it grew significantly from there. I think as I said, Nicole's initial idea was for a special issue of the magazine, which we did do, but we also created various other forms of the idea. There was a multi-episode podcast that many people listened to. There was an event at the National Museum of African American History and Culture. There was a kind of broadsheet visual history lesson about things you maybe didn't learn about slavery in school. We put together a whole bunch of stuff, and it had such a huge impact that we quickly began to think about creating it in a more lasting form. And that led to us doing this book, which took a little longer than we expected because the pandemic arrived not long after that and just kind of ground everything to a halt. But, we spent about 2 years working on developing the magazine issue into a book. And that involved bringing in some new contributors, Jamel had a wonderful essay in the original magazine version. And so yes. original contributors like Jamel were able to expand on their essay and sometimes respond to things that were happening, you know, like the obviously we published the magazine issue before 2020, before the George Floyd protests, before the COVID pandemic, and the magazine the book came after it. So we were able to reflect on many things that happened as Jamel did, writing about the attempted insurrection at the Capitol in his revised version of his essay. But then we were also able to bring in wonderful new contributors like Martha and many others. So that was a really exciting process.
Well, congratulations, because it's just wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
I want to turn to you, Martha. I know that this book is subtitled The Origin Story. How do you feel about that? What are your thoughts on calling it The Origin Story? How does centering our origin story around race change our understanding of the American story?
Thanks for that, Diane. You know, I in some ways thought of this project as a grand and a very serious thought experiment, one that I, as a historian of the Black American experience, engage in regularly, right? Which is what happens when we put Black Americans at the center of our narratives. What happens when we put those stories not to the margins, not as sidebars, not as exceptions, but we treat them as the main story. And in my own essay in this volume now, this book on citizenship, I was able to foreground the essential defining role, in fact, that Black Americans played in the citizenship regime that many Americans become citizens by, and that is birthright citizenship. So here we're able to tell the way in which the matter of citizenship, which is a question, a concern for all Americans and for those who aspire to be Americans, when we center Black Americans, we discover, in fact, a whole new facet of that story.
It was such a huge problem for Black people to gain citizenship. I mean, at first, they were completely ruled out. We'll get back to how that process went. But first, I do want to turn to you, Jamel. The idea of John Calhoun and his legacy and how that fits in to what's happening in our country today.
Sure. So when the original magazine package was being planned, Jake and Nicole approached me about writing with regards to politics, sort of the relationship between slavery and politics, the kind of the long influence of slavery on politics. And I thought a lot about this, and the approach I decided to take was not to think so much in terms of institutions, but to think in terms of ideologies. And one thing that I wanted to impress upon people was that slavery, because it was a system of labor, because it was a way to organize a society, also produced a bunch of ideologies to justify that, to explain that, to kind of rationalize the system that had emerged. And so sort of when you're thinking about the ideology of slavery, the ideology of slaveholders, kind of the paramount person, like the person who stands tall as really, I mean, this could sound really weird to say, but as like a legitimately major figure in the history of American intellectual thought, it's John C. Calhoun, the South Carolina slave owner, planter, statesman. He was sort of recognized during his life as being one of the great living statesmen of the United States, and someone who, from kind of the midpoint of his career onwards, became one of the most vocal and vociferous and sophisticated defenders of the slave system and of slavery as a way of organizing, or of racial chattel slavery as a way of organizing a society. And the ideology that Calhoun advances is one that sort of is at odds with what you might call the majoritarian assumptions of big parts of the American system. Whereas someone like James Madison would say, well, the only fair way we can kind of really decide once we have all this representation sorted out is for the majority to decide and to deliberate. Calhoun argued, well, no, that's ridiculous. Every single major interest in the society deserves to have veto power over the decisions of the society. For him, he was thinking about slaveholders. And this idea, this notion of how to decide, and whether it should be majoritarian, or you might say minoritarian, a veto to each individual, defined interest, goes on to have just a long influence on the history of American political thought up to and including the present. And so that's why I thought it would be interesting to sort of like tackle Calhoun as a figure, because I think his vision of what the American Republic ought to look like and sort of his assumptions about the way to order a society really do influence successive generations of Americans, even as the ideas themselves become a bit attenuated from slavery, right? Like, no one's defending, I wouldn't say no one, but not that many people are defending in the middle of the 20th century the slave system, but they are adapting Calhoun's ideas to the political situation in the middle of the 20th century.
For example, give me an example of how you see that.
There is a book from the middle of the 20th century called The South and the Concurrent Majority. And the concurrent majority is one of Calhoun's big ideas. This is the idea that instead of a numerical majority making decisions, or the representatives of a numerical majority, you have sort of concurrent assent from different segments of the society. In this book, which is by a late historian, David Potter, talks about how, obviously there was never any constitutional reform to impose a concurrent majority, but if you look at how the South functioned in two-party politics for about 100 years in terms of its veto power within the Democratic Party, and kind of thus a kind of national veto in a lot of issues. If you look at the composition of the Senate, if you look at the filibuster rule, if you look at the seniority rules that used to govern the House or up until relatively recently, what you would see essentially is a white South that exercised a veto over all major issues of national concern. And that is sort of a Calhounite idea. It's sort of, it is the prospect of losing that in the 1940s when the Democratic Party begins to make its shift on civil rights is what inspires the Dixiecrat revolt. And you see this idea pop up again and again in the 50s and the 60s that, right, the civil rights movement is illegitimate because it's not taking into consideration the interest of the white South. Don't they get a veto on what happens there too? And so sort of just in, I think just in kind of, American party politics, you sort of see Calhoun's ideas bear fruit. But I think you can see them throughout modern day American politics, and especially in this idea that there are some people who are legitimate actors, legitimate people who can wield power in American politics, and some people who aren't, and whose views and votes don't really count.
And that's why I want to get to the question of race. Where did the idea of race come from? How did it emerge? Martha, when did Black people become Black people and whites become whites?
Well, if I could answer that in the short time of this show, I would really be earning my salary, because this is a question that historians have debated for generations. And we have important work that looks back really to the ancient world, to ideas about Blackness, ideas about difference that change and evolve and adapt over time, but we see then manifest in North America concurrent with the emergence of slavery in what becomes the United States. But I should say, there are other historians who would say that race doesn't really enter sort of ideologically speaking, U.S. thought until after the Civil War, when in fact slavery is abolished and now a new logic, a new regime, the Jim Crow regime, gains ascendancy. And that is a regime that is rooted in not just race, but racism. We could tell the story through science. We could tell the story through literature. We could still tell the story through many kinds of idioms. But there's no question that for the story that this book tells, part of what it is charting out is precisely that question, is how and by what terms race, and it's important to say racism, begins to play a major role in American thought, politics, law, and more. I see Jake nodding, so I hope he's gonna help me here.
Well, I would just add, I mean, I think Martha's right. We could obviously spend the whole hour talking about this, but I would only add that to go back to your original question, Diane, about why this is subtitled an origin story. Specifically, it's a new origin story. I think we were trying to very consciously set it apart from, you know, existing origin stories. But to my point, you know, part of what makes slavery in the United States unique is that it was racial slavery. We're not the only nation on earth that had racial slavery, but we're one of the few, and we're certainly the only nation on earth that had racial slavery that also proclaimed freedom and equality for all as our founding principle. And I think that that combination is from the way the we're the sort of argument about an origin story that we're putting forth, that contradiction is incredibly generative of so many of the conflicts and tensions and problems in American life that follow, of a racial slavery system and a founding principle that all people are created equal. That creates a cognitive dissonance that has to be solved by a whole bunch of pernicious ideas and ideologies that are, many of which are still with us today in some form.
So where did slavery exist before it existed here in the United States, Jamel?
That's another a very big question, Diane. The very, very short version is that forms of slavery have pretty much existed for as long as there have been human society. It's just kind of a thing that humans have done in the, you know, in North Africa, in the Indian Ocean, in the Mediterranean. Going back to antiquity, there had been sort of a kind of like slave trade, right? But slavery in North America is sort of a product of, you know, European exploration of the Americas, of the Caribbean, of South America, the subsequent colonization of these places, the creation of sort of like an economic system for trying to extract wealth from these places and bring it back to Europe, and then the need for labor. There's initially enslavement of Native Americans on island of Hispaniola in South America. It attempts at doing this in North America as well. But sort of the consequences of this, but just sort of the mass killing of many natives makes it sort of economically unviable. There is a period of indentured, you know, the large importation of indentured servants to the Americas. This is a big aspect of a forced labor in North America, but there are all these sort of political and economic complications that arise from that. Yeah. And it's the African slavery enters the picture as basically sort of like a way to solve the labor problem without exacerbating the political concerns that come with like kidnapping a bunch of English people, for example, if we're thinking of Britain. And also, Africans, by virtue of being phenotypically distinct, by virtue of not necessarily speaking the same language, by virtue of having different religious practices, you're able to separate them, you're able to mark them, you're able to kind of create states of exception for these people. And I tend to think of this as like primarily driven by the need for large amounts of labor for plantation agriculture. That pressure ends up being the engine that gives the transatlantic slave trade its fuel is not a thing that makes any sense, but that's what I'm going to say. And it's out of this And out of the efforts to rationalize this, to create justifications for it, to explain it away in law, right, that begins to produce the ideas and ideologies and categories that I think modern Americans are familiar with. And the other thing I feel impelled to emphasize is that although I think Americans, United States Americans, can be very parochial about this stuff, it's important to remember that sort of the large bulk of enslaved Africans were brought to South America and the Caribbean. That's sort of, we got, you know, North America got like a small fraction, and it's for a bunch of contingent historical reasons that we end up becoming kind of like the paradigmatic, you know, slave society in this hemisphere. But the bulk of enslaved Africans do not arrive in North America. They arrive elsewhere and shape those societies in profound ways as well.
Jake, do you want to add to that?
I would just add one thing to Jamel's excellent kind of explainer, which is that it's true that a relative smaller percentage of enslaved Africans were brought to the British North American colonies and United States while the slave trade was still legal after the country was founded. And a much larger majority were taken to Brazil and the West Indies and other countries in South America. But some of that had to do with the way that the US system was, and another thing that I think is unique about the US system was how closed it was, how difficult it was to get out of. Extremely difficult to if you were enslaved, to become free if you were in the United States. And also I think, you know, and Martha can speak to this with more authority, one of the other distinguishing factors of the system in the United States was that it was marked by natural increase rather than a lot of new importations of enslaved people. It was unusual in world history of slave societies to have a slave society that had so much reproduction. And there are lots of different reasons for that. It's debated why, but it marks, it's another thing that marks our system as unique and is worth, you know, noting.
Because, of course, the women who became enslaved were used by their white masters to create more children through rape, through some kind of relationship. It just went on and on, including Thomas Jefferson, one of the heroes of this country. Martha.
Yeah, I'll jump in and say that you're right to point out the terrible but central role that sexual violence plays in this story. Jefferson's is a story we've come to know well, I think, in the last two decades. But as historian Joshua Rothman has put it, you know, it's notorious in the neighborhood, right? Everybody knows about Jefferson, and everybody in early America, colonial America, knows about the role that sexual violence is playing. I did want to just loop back to the important points that Jamel and Jacob just made to say that, you know, one of the things that this book has generated is an important comparative public conversation about the history of slavery in the Americas. In some sense, I think every slave society could tell its history for the ways in which it's unique. But one of the things we recognize is that North America is not the first place, right, to rely upon enslaved Africans in the Americas as laborers. It is not the last place to abolish slavery. Brazil and Cuba will follow later in the 19th century. So we have this opportunity by focusing on and developing this story to also invite folks to do, if I could say, other reading on the syllabus about how the story of enslavement in North America fits into the story of the hemisphere more broadly.
We have a question from one of our listeners. Could one argue that the Jim Crow regime was more important to the post-Civil War and contemporary racism than slavery itself? Put another way, if Reconstruction had been a thoroughgoing process and success, would that have solved the problems of race, Jake?
Another question that's almost impossible to answer. But I mean, certainly had Reconstruction been a success, there might not have been a need for a second Reconstruction, as many people call the civil rights era. And I think it's important to see a lot of the conversation around race and racism, the conflicts that we're still dealing with literally right now around subjects like teaching history in schools or affirmative action, et cetera, as downstream from the upheavals of that second Reconstruction, as essentially reaction to a wholesale change in the way society is going to orient itself around this central question of race. Another way to think about that is we struggled since our founding to be an equal society and didn't even really begin to succeed until the 1960s when, when with the second Reconstruction, we began to have citizenship rights extended to all. And here we are only 50 years later or so, fighting over a lot of the reforms that came about at that time.
The question we have from David: we are seeing so much blowback on this project. How much support does it have among grassroots Black communities, working class Black people, compared to Black academics and white academics? Does this actually have any impact on the people I mentioned, or is it causing more controversy than good? What do you think, Jamel?
That's a good question. Because I'm not sure if I'm in a position to make any like broad pronouncements, but I'll say that the first time I heard the date 1619, when I was 8 or 9, and I found a copy of Before the Mayflower, I think a very kind of famous book in Black, public life, which is about the arrival of Africans in British North America. And the person who had the copy Before the Mayflower, if I remember correctly, was my grandfather, who was like a railroad worker. Like, it's just a book that he happened upon and he found and he read. Which is to say that sort of like among working class African Americans, these conversations people have been having them for a long time, right? Sort of like the Black community, broadly speaking, for most of its history has been like working class. And so a lot of these ideas, a lot of these arguments have been like worked out among Black people, by people doing, all sorts of manual labor and blue collar work for decades. These questions precede us. These arguments precede us, many of them by many, many years. So my hunch is that in judging from sales numbers and sort of all that stuff, is that like the 1619 Project is a part of the discourse amongst ordinary African Americans, that it isn't like an elite imposition, but it's something that people are engaging with and engaging with in an organic way, I think.
If I could jump in, Diane, I'll offer a little anecdote. Total evidence to Jamel's point, because I'm one who's been out, whether it's in here in Washington in the public library or online, as I was this past weekend with the Pulitzer Center, and I'm seeing hundreds and hundreds of folks coming out to public events, rolling up their sleeves, grappling with their own ideas, grappling with the ideas of this book. And so, when I, on a Saturday afternoon, find myself in front of nearly 200 educators, I realize this book is doing more work than simply fueling academic debates, that it is generating important conversations. And it's my view, it may not be everybody's view, those folks don't have to agree with every idea that I put forward in the book or every idea in the book itself. But as a historian, I'm deeply moved by how folks have come to the table, and this has become an opportunity to revisit, to debate, to talk about, to learn, and to have history be part of the fabric of our national conversation. And at least for me, that's not a conversation I'm especially having with my colleagues in the history department at all, frankly. It's a conversation I'm having with educators and with folks from the general public.
Can I just add one thing, Dan? I think sure. that I agree with everything that Jamel and Martha said. And I would just say that the popularity of the book and the engagement with the project by average people who are not academics is precisely the reason why there's been such a strong backlash against it and effort to get it out of schools and ban it. It's not, you don't try to ban something that nobody's paying any attention to except, you know, historians or academics. It's the mass popularity of the book in the sense that it is actually bringing a lot more people to ideas that, as Jamel made the point earlier, have been discussed whether in the Black community or more recently in the academy for many, many years. It's not like we invented any of these ideas. Bringing those ideas to a much larger group of people than they had been, I think, is part of what has made the book a target for that kind of backlash.
Here's a question from a listener that I personally have heard raised numerous times. It says, I thought the book overall was terrific, but it did seem to stretch to root the American Revolution in the desire to protect slavery when the founders justified the rebellion in terms of Enlightenment ideas, and most of the leaders were committed to rebellion, if not outright independence, before Lord Dunsmore's offer of freedom to slaves who would fight for the crown. Comments, Martha?
You know, I am not going to speak for Nicole this afternoon and her essay. I understand, I think I have followed carefully the trajectory of the debate around a very small bit, but a consequential bit of her essay. And my understanding, you know, as in my reading of her revised essay, is that she has sort of taken counsel and qualified some of the claims.
Right.
I'm glad somebody asked this question because it is obviously something that there's been a lot of debate around. I mean, the sentence that the questioner is keying in on is a sentence that was in Nicole's original essay. And that was subject to a lot of debate and even controversy in the months after the magazine was published, long before the book was published. And the sentence, I'll attempt to do it from memory, now I can't do it from memory, but it essentially says that contrary to what our founding myth holds, one of the primary reasons that the colonists decided to declare their independence from Britain was to protect the institution of slavery. And we recognized after the fact that there was a imprecision to that sentence, because what we intended to suggest was that among the reasons of all these different colonists, some of them were nervous about their status of their enslaved people and whether or not those enslaved people would either be stirred up to revolt against them by the British, or perhaps, you know, the British crown would begin to move against the legality of slavery in the colonies, as they had already begun to do back on British soil following the Somerset decision. I mean, we could get into all of that colonial history here, but the main point is that I would make is that I've now remembered the very beginning to that sentence, which I wanted to start with, which is conveniently left out of our founding mythology. The main point that I would make about that sentence that has caused so much controversy is that she's making a historical point, which is that some of the colonists sought to protect slavery by declaring independence from Britain. A debatable point, but a point that has plenty of support for it and many contemporary historians would endorse.
Right.
But that's only part of what she's saying. She's also making a kind of more historiographical point, if we might put it that way, which is that it's been left out of our founding mythology that anything other than a commitment to Enlightenment ideals of freedom was at the root of the Declaration of Independence from Britain. And that, you know, complicating that founding mythology, first of all, even indicating to readers that it is a mythology, that it's been constructed to sort of provide a certain kind of purpose, for subsequent generations. And that if we sort of poke and prod at it and try to understand the true motivations of the many different people who were involved in making those decisions and articulating why they were doing so in a variety of ways, we begin to understand the complexity and in some cases the ugliness of what went into what we tend to think of as a purely heroic act.
So, but you did alter the sentence somewhat.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't explain that. After we published the conveniently left out of our founding mythology is the fact that, you know, one of the primary reasons the colonists decided, we changed that 3 months later, not in the book, but just 3 months later, to conveniently left out of our founding mythology is the fact that one of the primary reasons some of the colonists we just wanted to clarify, we didn't obviously mean that the colonists were a, you know, unified, homogenous mass of people who are all acting the same. All the different colonies had very different interests. And so therefore the people coming to the table from the different colonies at that time would have had different interests. So we added the phrase some of. That basically is the same sentence that appears in the book, but Martha's right that Nicole has revised the whole essay around that sentence to include a lot more support for that. What I think to many people was a kind of shocking statement. She's got a lot more support for that. She delves into why, you know, what parts of the colonies would have felt that way and why. So it's a more substantiated point in the book.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of Diane's conversation with Jamel Bowie, Martha S. Jones, and Jake Silverstein. It was recorded on Wednesday, February 23rd, as part of Diane's monthly book club and author interview series.
I have to say there were parts of this book that were absolutely horrific. For one, the Oklahoma massacre of what had become Black Wall Street, the taking away of what free slaves had built for themselves in that state, and which white Oklahomans decided was too good for black people, and destroyed that whole town, took away the property, killed hundreds. Jamel, I've seen references to that before, but reading it in this book brought it that much more alive. Describe far better than I what happened.
This is the destruction of Greenwood in Tulsa that has in the last few years really, I think, come into public consciousness much more than it had been prior. And sort of the larger phenomenon of these sort of pogroms against Black communities in this period has come to sort of much greater attention in terms of Americans' historical memory than I think ever before. I think it's actually a very sort of remarkable and unique thing. And I think one thing the Tulsa massacre can illuminate and you know, contemporaneous events like the Red Summer of 1919, the Rosewood massacre of 1923, sort of not too long ago, that's in Florida. There's the Elaine massacre in Arkansas. There's unfortunately many of these to point to, but I think one thing that they can reveal or illustrate is that, you know, Americans are so used to thinking about racism in terms of sort of just like, you know, prejudices and hatred, that it's sort of hard to see these things in terms of sort of interest and ideology, right? And so it's sort of like something like the Tulsa massacre is in part driven by kind of just, you know, ugly prejudice, but it's also driven by kind of the concrete interest of white business people and white workers in the town who see in Greenwood economic competition, who see in it like a threat to their own status as patriarchs, as, you know, free and independent white men. And I think that one sort of thinking of the book as a whole, one benefit of thinking through the course of U.S. history with an eye towards race or with race as a filter is I think it can assist in demystifying race and demystifying the way that race actually works, which isn't simply as a, again, a set of sort of like hatreds and prejudice and such, but as like a way of like structuring how people understand themselves, as a way of sort of structuring disadvantage and inequality, as a way of structuring labor relations amongst groups. And that's something that I think is difficult to see given how Americans usually talk about this stuff. And, you know, for what it's worth, yeah, it can help explain some of the backlash. Like when you begin to demystify and denaturalize this stuff, you're going to run into conflict with people who do want to naturalize racial inequality and naturalize existing racial disadvantage and say that this is just a product of how these people are versus a specific set of things that happened historically. And that, like, you know, you can trace A to B to C to D.
I was stunned to learn that freed black slaves were actually rejected by Illinois, Indiana, Minnesota. They would not allow freed black slaves to come into their states. Did they have to have a reason? Did they attempt to justify their actions, Martha, or did they simply say, you are not welcome here?
This is a debate that consumes the country at many moments across our first half century and more. Who are Black Americans before the Constitution? Are they citizens of the United States? Are they entitled to the protections and the privileges that citizens of the United States, white citizens of the United States, enjoy? And for all of our history until we get to the years after the Civil War, this is an open question that is, yes, being debated in Congress, yes, being debated in high courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, but is also playing out much closer to the ground, especially in those Western states, right? As the nation expands, as new states join the Union, now the question arises, can they set their own terms when it comes to who is in and who is out? And you're right to point out, right, that many states look to wholesale bar Black Americans, free Black Americans from entering. And it's not clear that those Black Americans have an ultimate recourse. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1857 will try and settle this question by basically saying no, right, that Black people have no rights that these states are bound to respect. That won't quite settle the question, but it's to say it is a profoundly vexed matter. And it is an opening for us to appreciate how Black Americans are politically engaged, politically organized, politically savvy, and are looking, indeed, whether it's in a local legislature or it's at the Supreme Court, are looking to shape the outcome of those kinds of debates.
However, in the Washington Post just yesterday, we learned that the Faculty Council of the University of Texas at Austin approved 41-5 with 3 abstentions, a resolution rejecting any attempts by bodies external to the faculty to restrict or dictate the content of university curriculum on any matter, including matters related to racial and social justice, whereupon Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, a Republican, denounced the resolution, saying that I will not stand up and let loony Marxist University of Texas professors poison the minds of young students with critical race theory. And on Friday, Patrick said he would support ending the job protection measure known as tenure for professors who teach critical race theory. So, Jamel, that brings us right to politics back then to politics now.
Yes, I mean, we are in the midst of a strong backlash, although I'm not necessarily sure it's a broad backlash, but at least a strongly felt backlash to not just the 1619 Project, not just sort of the 2020 George Floyd protest, but sort of, I think, the larger effort for the past 5 or 6 years, I mean, longer than that, 7 or 8 years, to re-engage with and recontextualize the nation's history. From, you know, Confederate statues to, you know, statues of people and memorials to people whom have long been held in esteem. And it's interesting to think about what beyond kind of just like, I don't like this thing that's happening, that's driving this. The hunch I have, the thing that makes sense to me, is that I do think that there has been a real sea change in how many millions of Americans have begun to understand the country's history. And this isn't sort of like an embrace. And this is the funny thing. I don't think it's an embrace of sort of like anti-Americanism as much as it's sort of a willingness to kind of sit with the ugliness of the country's past in addition to the things that people admire. I think the scope of the George Floyd protests, you know, 15, 16 million Americans protesting, is a testament to how questions of racial justice have really moved to the center of, I think, how many Americans, many more Americans evaluate the nation's history. And that has implications beyond intellectual ones, right? Like, the extent to which people have learned about redlining, for example, the extent to which redlining is entered into the national lexicon as a set of policies that happen that have an impact today, that actually impacts contemporary policy debates. To get back to something I said a little earlier, if persistent unemployment among Black communities is a function of like specific policy choices in the specific way we've structured our society, and if that's the thing that you learn from, you know, reading history and reading sociology and studying, then that has implications for what you do about those things today. It means that you may resist efforts to say, well, we should keep the government out of this. We should leave things to the private sector. And it may encourage a more sort of activist sense of what should be done. And I think that this current backlash is in a lot of ways a backlash to that development, right? Sort of, it's backlash to this real change that's happened in the way many Americans view and perceive this country's history, in an attempt to kind of put the genie back into the bottle, right? To echo what Jake said earlier, none of this backlash would be the case if what is ongoing isn't as broad and powerful as it is. The ferocity with which, you know, conservative lawmakers are approaching this does not make sense unless you kind of grant that there really has been a significant change, and it really does promise to at least like alter the way millions of Americans understand their country and understand their country's politics.
Can I just add that I think it's interesting too that the form that that response, that backlash takes is in the language of a lot of these anti-CRT laws that have been passed in state legislatures. You know, it sort of comes across, it's designed to come across as seeming very reasonable, like no student should be taught that anybody is, you know, inferior because of their race. Well, of course, I mean, you know, we all would agree with that. There's a whole approach that has, I think, been buildings over the last 50 years to respond to kind of race consciousness, whether it's in the fields of law or policy or history, with a kind of protest that we should be colorblind in how we think about all these things. And that's obviously the argument that that we're going to see at the Supreme Court later this year against affirmative action. And it's the argument that you see against, you know, history, which is increasingly over the last, you know, 30 to 50 years, been doing a much better job than it ever did before, American historians, of understanding Black perspectives, the perspectives of people essentially other than, you know, elite white males in our history. And the response to that has been that we have to stop seeing things through the lens of race, which is just absurd when you think about it. Like, you can't have a society in which, I mean, to your point earlier, Diane, about the fact that in many Western territories, free Black people were not allowed to live, or that in many Southern slave states, if you happened to manage to win your freedom, you had to leave within, you know, 60 days or something like that. A society in which slave or free status doesn't matter. The only thing that matters, the only thing that defines one as a pariah is being Black. That a society so obsessed with race can't turn on a dime and say, well, we're going to just be colorblind.
Yeah.
Once citizenship rights have been extended to everybody. And I think that's what we see in a lot of this backlash to the 1619 Project, to the boogeyman of critical race theory, is this counter argument that I think is persuasive to some people who hear it, that this is what Roberts said in the Shelby decision, the only way to end race-based discrimination is to stop discriminating on the basis of race, which doesn't quite make sense in the real world.
I wonder, we had almost 2,000 people sign up for today's discussion. I wonder whether you have been surprised, or maybe you expected this kind of outpouring for the book. Martha, you are shaking your head. Yes.
I'm heartened, and I'll tell you why. One of the most frequent comments I get from readers, from audience members, from students is, I didn't learn this in school. This isn't the history I learned in school.
Why didn't I
learn this in school? And so what I see sort of in the groundswell around this book is a tremendous appetite, right, on the part of Americans who understand that in various ways their educations taught them too little of what they needed to know in order to be present, in order to be critical, in order to be citizens in the 21st century. So woe to the citizens of Texas, right, if their lieutenant governor is going to suppress the work of what is frankly one of the most distinguished history departments in this country at the University of Texas at Austin, because those are the folks who are helping us to undo the suppression and the indoctrination, frankly, that was the teaching of U.S. history in too many places for too long. And so I think we should be heartened when folks show up. We should be heartened when they debate us, because we all recognize that there is more that we need to know about the American past than we got in school.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, I want to thank you all so much. Martha S. Jones, Jamel Bowie, and Jake Silverstein, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you for having us.
That was Diane's February 23rd conversation with Jamel Bowie, Martha S. Jones, and Jake Silverstein, contributors to the 1619 Project, A New Origin Story. To find out more about the Diane Rehm Book Club and author interview series, go to dianerehm.org/bookclub. And that's all for today. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brumberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. Today's show was produced by me, Allison Brody, with help from Kenny Pirog. Thanks for listening.